the practice that leads to liberation, to enlightenment. So it's a particularly beautiful practice to not just to study and hear about, but to practice in our lives. And so some of you may have already taken refuge and, you know, been Buddhist, and then others may not. Some you might have done it formally or informally. So whatever reason, it's important to reflect on, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean in our lives? So the basic situation of all of us, as the Buddha pointed out, is that we all want to be happy. None of us wants to suffer. So it's the first teaching, the Four Noble Truths, first teaching of the Buddha. So this pretty much occupies our mind 24 hours a day. You know, this sort of desire for things that will bring us happiness, and our aversion to things that are going to bring us unhappiness or even suffering, dukkha, dissatisfaction, something a bit not quite sitting right. So then, so if we check everything that we do has this motivation. Either we do things because we believe it will bring us happiness, or we think we can avoid suffering by doing them. So from the moment we get up to when we go back to bed. So especially when we are feeling suffering, we do something about it. Myself, I've had a cold all this week, so I sort of took care of that. You do, don't you? You go to the chemist and say, can you give me these lozenges and this spray, and I want to feel comfortable. I didn't go and get drugs from the doctor and suppress it, but if I was bad enough, I would. So we do. We do these things to not suffer on a very literal level, physically. You know? And so this sort of seeking for ways of not suffering, seeking for safe haven, something that makes us feel comfortable, something that makes us, you know, avoid suffering, that can be called a refuge. So you know, having the idea of having a refuge or taking refuge is not just a Buddhist idea. You know, we have a particular meaning of it in Buddhism, but it's not just that. It's something we've done all our life. Buddhist or not. I didn't grow up Buddhist myself. I grew up Catholic. Is anybody else there? you know, for me, a long time, my refuge was the Catholic Church, so, as a child. So, or my bedroom, or my toys. Well, you know, we all have different things we take refuge in, right? So, first off, when we're very young, our first refuge is our mother, generally, or whoever has taken on our mother role in our life. So our mother, you know, comforts us. You know, when you see with babies when they're crying, what does mum do? You know, pacify. Or maybe not always, you know, there's different techniques, but generally we want to comfort, and we want that comfort. So that's the role of a mother. So, and then when things have went wrong for us when we were young, what did we do? Run to mummy. Help! Save me! I'm hurting. So, when we were a child, you know, our mother or whoever brought us up played a wonderful role solving our problems, taking care of us, feeding us, clothing us, doing all of these things for us. So, we relied on. So, taking refuge is something, someone that we rely on, that we, you know, they're going to look after our needs, you know, care for us. And so, so as we grew older, maybe we had a sense that, you know, our mother, in my case, because I was Catholic, wasn't God. You know, I suddenly realised my mother wasn't God, wasn't omniscient, wasn't, you know, didn't know everything in the world. She knew quite a bit, but not everything. And that, you know, then we start looking for other refuges as we grow up. So we might take refuge in money. You know, that's going to bring me happiness, right? I get a good job, get the right amount of money, that will keep me happy. And money can buy a lot of things, but does it buy happiness? So we can see in our society there is a strong belief that money buys happiness. You only have to look at all the ads on the television and the ads going down the street. Actually, I was driving this monk to the airport this morning, and I can't even remember the slogan. But anyway, there was this big ad up there, and it was something about Roger, and it sort of didn't make sense. He says, "What's that? What's that?" It was one of those big poster billboards. He said, "What's that an ad for?" I said, "I don't know." And it was, had this like cartoon dog there, and I said, "I don't know. Maybe it's children's film, whatever." But we're both looking at it, and so it got your attention, didn't it? So, and then when I was driving back from the airport, I thought, I'll find out, and when I pick him up, I can tell him what it was. And it was Schmeckos. You know, Schmeckos, it's a dog treat. So it's this ad for a dog treat, and it got our attention, we were right there. So, you know, we could have been providing that refuge for the dog. You know, here's some Schmeckos, that will make you happy. So we look for things to make us happy. And people who do advertising know how to get our attention in that direction. This will make you happy. To a dog, Schmeckos make them pretty happy as far as I can see. In the dog's eyes head anyway. So we also, you know, look for things like power, fame. You know, we talk about the eight worldly concerns, the things that, you know, that we think, reputation, fame, this is going to bring me happiness. You know, if only people recognize my worth, you know. And we can see by people, you can see as time goes on, you can see like film stars, or you can see people who are, you know, top of corporations and things like this. And then something happens and it's gone, isn't it? So that if it's not permanent, it can't provide any permanent solution. And so then those people who thought this was going to provide them every happiness, then are very unhappy because suddenly it's gone and you've lost it. I mean, that's a dramatic end. But we can see how these things aren't lasting, they don't last forever. Or our friends, even. You know, we take refuge in our friends. We surround ourselves with people who will care for us, who will protect us, who will make us happy. And if they ever don't do that, or we start to doubt whether they're our friend or not, right? Are you really my friend? You know, or, and then sometimes those people aren't anymore in our lives. You know, I thought you were my friend, and now look what you've done, and blah, 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 blah. Some people have insurance policies for, you know, protection. So I'm not saying don't have insurance policies. You know, but we do. We take out life insurance, health insurance. So far, I don't think you can take out insurance for any more than one life, is that right? You can't sort of take out, you know, until as many lives as I ever have. I hope I haven't seen that. But maybe one day, who knows? We take, you know, refuge in drugs. I'm not talking illegal drugs here, right? You know, but, you know, alcohol. People, I was driving here, and I was driving another teacher from my centre, and he was going to Newtown, so, and we're talking about the traffic, and it's like, I said, oh, it's too early for people to be out, you know, doing the Friday night thing. He said, oh, no, 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 they're already in the pub drinking now. Oh, really? I don't go to pubs, I don't know. But apparently they do. Oh, we know they do. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pubs down there in Sydney, so you can tell Australia's very good at pubs. So, truly. True. So people take refuge in that, you know, end of the working week, what you're going to do, hang out down the pub with your mates. So believing that that's going to give them some sort of happiness. You know, we take refuge in shopping, even me. I have to say, I always say, you know, I never want anything until I go into a shopping centre. And then, I don't know, you're surrounded by stuff. And suddenly it's half price. And you never wanted it, but it's a bargain, and so you want it. And then you think, well, what am I going to do with that now? You know, so it gives you this moment of pleasure, and then that pleasure's gone. So we discover that, you know, our mother's not a perfect refuge. You know, all these things that we are seeking after don't solve our problems. You know, they don't bring an end to our suffering completely. You know, maybe temporary, but then we find, because just the fact that we live have a life, we will suffer. You know, we will always suffer sickness. We will always suffer death, and hopefully we will suffer aging.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody suffers aging, do they? But hopefully, you know, we have. So some of us, if not all of us, you know, come to the Buddha Dharma because we know that these things don't provide us happiness. We know that these things that we've relied on to overcome our suffering and bring happiness don't really work. What we find the causes of suffering, if we come to the second noble truth, keep coming back. So the causes aren't really, so we only got to look for something stronger, a stronger refuge. And there's really nothing out there in the world, you know, people or things that are going to do that for us. So we eventually realize that it's not out there. And then we realize that the source of our suffering actually comes in our own mind. You know, that whatever happens in the world, good evening. So whatever happens in the world outside is not the cause of our suffering. And this is where the distinction of Buddhism to other religions. So I worked for a while in the Philippines, because it's a predominantly Catholic country, and I was with these people who say, what has God got against us? You know, we have volcanoes erupting and we have landslides. When I was there, this happened. You know, what has God got against us? I don't think it's God. I don't think it comes from God. I don't think God sees, you know. Anyway, so we want this sense of being saved from ourselves, our environment, or whatever. And I think it's really interesting, actually, because if you look at if I look at the history in Australia, you go back to, even not going back to, you know, sort of Aboriginal people arriving, blah, 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 blah. But even like during like conflict times and stuff like that, people did want to have everything comfortable. But apparently I'm told today that our houses have to be bigger, everything has to be more comfortable. Like we want everything much more comfortable. More comfort, more safety, more haven. Why? I don't know. So we see that it's our own mind, and the more that we listen to the teachings of the Buddha, the more we understand that this suffering is a result of it's not that things don't happen that are horrible in the world, of course they do, but how we respond to things. Or even the stories we make up, even when nothing bad is happening. You know, that we can make up a whole story. We don't even have to have met somebody. We see them and we do this whole story about them and, you know, run the whole movie and obsess in our minds. And then they talk to you and it's nothing like the movie. It's nothing, you know, maybe it is. But anyway, often it's not. Nothing like the movie. But like if you say you see somebody and you think, oh, they look pretty cute, and then you sort of think ahead and think, well, you know, maybe if I ask them out, and maybe, you know, and then maybe if we got married, and then maybe blah, 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 and then we'll probably get divorced, and then we'll probably hate each other, and all over before you even said hello. You know, so our minds are very quick to do that, aren't they? To tell a whole story that hasn't even happened, and we don't even realize. And then we think that's real. We think what we make up in our mind is real. A little bit crazy. So that we more that we understand that it is our mind that's the source of our suffering. And by the way, the good news is, third noble truth, it's also the source of all our happiness. So there is a cessation to all this suffering, and you know that our mind can be equally happy as it can be suffering. So then the thing is, how to change our mind, how to change it radically. So if we change our mind a little bit, we'll overcome a bit of suffering. If God change our mind radically, we can, as the Buddha says, overcome all suffering. We can be completely free, not anything at all. So this is like a real revolution to completely eliminate anything that disturbs us, any anxieties, any fears, any doubts, all these negative things that fill our mind, and to develop positive qualities of mind, like contemplating those when we're doing the meditation. That this is our true nature. The positive qualities are our true nature. These will never go away. These will only ever grow and grow. The negative states are, I always hear in the teachings, and I only hear in the teachings, adventitious, which means that they're not permanent. So if we don't pay them attention, though, eventually, like if you don't water a plant, it'll wither and die. So if you don't feed the negativity, it'll wither and die. So that we know that the happiness we're seeking is not something superficial, it's not like the quick fix. We're seeking something more lasting than that. I guess it's difficult to say what that is, more like it's an experience, because we all have our interpretation of what happiness is, but however it is, we want it to be perfect, we want it to be lasting, we want it to last. And that can only happen by eliminating all the disturbing thoughts. So the more that we understand that the problems arise in our own mind, the more that we find that a perfect refuge is about developing our own mind, having the methods to show us how we go about doing these thoughts that create all the stories, these negative emotions. Like, we need some refuge that is lasting and reliable. Our mother, when we're children, or even as adults, our mother is there to, try and stop our suffering, or help us solve our problems, or solve them for us, even if we didn't want to. but even now, like my mother's what, 88, I still go home to my mom. I think I might be looking after her a bit more than she is me, but still there's that sense, right, that your mum's always there for you, isn't there? So that is something reliable. But I know my mother's 88, she's had two near-death experiences already, or clinical death experiences already, so I know that she's not going to be there forever, she's not going to be there very much longer. So I know that that's not a reliable source, not a bad source of comfort and ease and reliability. I know that she loves me unconditionally. But we do want somebody who has those perfect abilities that we can always rely on. Then, conclusion, when we contemplate the qualities of a Buddha, is to say, well, I think I can trust the Buddha, right? I think I can rely on the Buddha. This Buddha, 2,500 odd years of track record there, it's pretty reliable. It's a bit longer than 88 years if I look at my mum. Nothing wrong with my mother, but she's going to die. We're all going to die. But so if we want to free our mind from suffering and develop all these qualities, we need to rely on a being that has done that. And that's what Shakyamuni Buddha said. Well, look, this is how to do it. And I will show you. Buddha can't take away our suffering. If our mothers could take away our suffering, boy, they would. Wouldn't they, in an instant? You see a being suffering and you don't like to see it suffering. If you could take it away, you would, wouldn't you? Anyone who's a doctor or a nurse or training in those directions, you immediately want to relieve suffering as quickly as possible. That's their job. So the definition of a Buddha is having that perfect mind. So a mind that's completely free of any faults, and having positive qualities in Tibetan. So Buddha is like the awakened mind. The mind, what did Buddha do when he got up from that Bodhi tree, and the it's a Jain ascetic who encountered, who said, what are you? Are you a magician? Are you from another world? You know, are you a god? And no, I'm awake. So having a completely awakened mind that sees everything perfectly as it is, not through all the filters of all our chit-chat in our minds and all our emotional neuroses and all of those sorts of things. In Tibetan, the word for Buddha is Sangye. The sun is having all those perfect, pure qualities, or you know, being purified of all the negative qualities. And Ye is like the possessor, the one who has that, those qualities. So it's like having evolved the mind to its fullest extent. You know, we always talk about, and particularly I'm sure at university, you're always talking about potential of our minds. You're studying, and as you study, you're learning more and more and more. And it's like your mind is limitless. And Buddha is the one who's achieved the state of fully developing mind to the point that there's nowhere more to develop it. So that is what we need to rely on, because that's what we want. Just like you study something at university, you want a reliable teacher. You want a teacher who knows what they're talking about, who sort of gone there before, right? And, you know, if you don't have a teacher like that, you think, oh, did I really know that much? No, I doubt. So the Buddha you can rely on really does know it. So this mind that has complete understanding. So it's like the Buddha was like the first scientist, really, of the science of the mind, the first psychologist. So we've got all this Western psychology. Is anyone training to be a psychologist here? No psychologist in a group like this. Can't believe it. So Western psychology is, you know, is about helping people relieve, you know, their mental problems. And so there's a lot of theories, there's a lot of practices that they do, a lot of, you know, different types of psychologists and psychotherapists and analysts and psychiatrists and all sort of scientists of the mind. And it's like they're catching up with Shakyamuni Buddha, what he was saying 2,500 years ago, the true science of the mind. So that is the invitation to us to really become our own inner scientists of our own mind, to really, you know, sort of become like that, like a Buddha. Just one example in psychology. There's a theory that, you know, in a lot of psychological theories that you should express anger. Anyone heard that? You know, it's healthy to express your anger. One should express your anger. Not quite what the Buddha said, right? Buddha didn't quite have the same take on anger. So Buddha taught that anger is incredibly harmful. And I don't think it's rocket science. If you know, around someone who's in a rage, you can feel that, can't you? You can feel the negativity and the power of that, even if they don't open their mouth. Is that correct? Right? You don't want to be there. You want to get out of there immediately. So you can think, if you can feel that, what about the whole environment? And what about all other little beings around there? I mean, everyone can feel that. So it has an effect on you, it has an effect on them and their mind. What's it doing to their mind? And what's it doing to you and anyone else around, copping the fallout? And what's it doing to the environment? So from a Buddhist point of view, you say anger is not healthy to express. And in fact, some scientists have done some tests more recently on people who express anger and then people who find some other way to manage that anger, to subdue them. Some way, it doesn't have to be through meditation, but some means of really being able to control that anger. And so that they found that that people who actually expressed their anger only actually in the end got angrier and angrier. Because why? Because like the Buddha says, we familiarize ourselves with whatever. So this is right, whatever we're familiar with, habitual in our mind, we keep going over and over and familiarize with that. And so I can remember one time, obviously before I was a nun, I was breaking up in a relationship, and I'd be on the phone to my friend and going, you know, just going over the breakup and everything that happened and how terrible and woe is me and isn't it awful. And I'd keep having this conversation, and after a while I thought, you know, I'm sick of this conversation. I'm just making myself unhappy. The more I talk, the more unhappy I get. So it's like that, isn't it? Like familiarizing your mind with unhappiness. Because, you know, it's great if you're breaking up in a relationship and all your friends are going to go, yeah, that's terrible. And so it encourages you more and more. You know, how dare they? Oh, I can't believe what they did. Blah, blah, blah. And it just makes us more and more unhappy. So this is what the Buddha said, this is not healthy. This is not the way to go. So in the short term you might feel like you've expressed something, but if you really sit with it, you realise your mind's just more disturbed. So it's not at all healthy. So really what we want to do is perfect our mind in a way it doesn't harm us, and it doesn't harm others, and it doesn't harm the environment. So for that, it's logical that we rely on a perfect mind that has achieved those things, so therefore a mind possessing all those positive qualities. Or does Buddha mind exist? Is there such a thing as a Buddha mind? So do we take it on faith, or do we know that for a fact? We obviously trust it, you're all here. So that, of course, you know, Buddhas do exist with that mind that's 100% free of fault. And once you achieve that, and we can all achieve it, it's irreversible. There's like, there's no going back once you've achieved that. So the Buddha mind does possess every positive quality, just like in the meditation, when you call to mind all the positive qualities. You don't have to be told what positive qualities are, you know. That's your own inner wisdom, your own inner Buddha nature. So ultimately your refuge is in you. It's not something out there. It's what's within each one of us. And that's what we said. Each being that has a mind can become enlightened. The cockroaches, the ants, the snakes, everything can become enlightened. Men, women, all of us. There's no exception. So these qualities want also never decline. So why do we want to take refuge? First thing is fear of suffering. We don't want to suffer. And we don't want to suffer in this lifetime. We don't want to suffer in any other lifetime. Thank you very much. So that's the thing of suffering in this lifetime, or fear of, if you believe in different realms of existence, lower realms, being reborn as an animal, or in other realms where the suffering is even more intense. So that's a very great motivation. So two things. One is that fear, and also faith in the qualities of the Buddha, and faith in our own ability to attain those qualities. So taking that refuge in the Buddha is not just to be for ourselves, fear of suffering for ourselves, to be relieved of that. But also we don't want to see other beings suffer, and if I don't know how to relieve their suffering, then I have to become a Buddha to understand how to perfectly relieve their suffering forever, or at least guide them, you know, sort of guide them to having that in the same way the Buddha guides. So one example is like, and this comes up a lot, is, you know, if you have a pet, and you're a pet animal, you've got a pet animal, cat, dog, snake, what? A dog, a pet dog. So, you know, vets don't like Buddhas. For anyone training to be a vet, I'm not trying to offend anybody, you know, but they say that vets don't like Buddhists very much because if our pets are dying, we don't necessarily want to have them put down because we don't know what their karma is. Because as an ordinary being, I mean, yes, you want them to be not suffering, right? But we don't really know if it's better for them to suffer in that body, in that life, than to be reborn and have some worse suffering for eons, or, you know, we don't know. Because we're not, or at least I don't know. I don't have clairvoyance, maybe you all do, but I wouldn't know. If we do know, then we can make a very clear decision. But we don't, and so the wisdom is that we let them, you know, suffer whatever suffering in this life. I mean, we had that whole debate about euthanasia, isn't it? And nobody, you know, the big debate, and the medicos don't say, put them, anyone training to be a doctor? You're trained to be a doctor? So what do they say in the doctor training? Do they say, put them out of their misery? Do they say, keep everybody alive at all costs?
It depends.
They don't say anything.
It depends on the law.
But I'm talking Australia, right, here, like that. You're training here, right? So what do they tell you here?
Depends on what the family wants.
Depends what the family wants.
And if the, you're potentially educated by
that,
has the ability to make a decision.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of that's if you've got the power to work with your mind, isn't it?
And you can't directly, like, cause the death.
That's right. You can't.
You can do nothing.
Yeah. So we take a lot of effort, don't we, to keep people alive. That's what your job is keeping you alive, isn't it? That's your job. So we do, we put a lot of effort into that and a lot of value on that in society. And the Buddha would say, equally you should put as much effort into keeping animals alive because they have a mind, and so even they might not in that life be able to do a lot with their mind in another life, you know, because in the next life or whatever. Anyway. So the fear of being reborn as in the lower realms or in some other suffering life is one of the reasons that we take refuge, one of the main reasons we take refuge, and also, as I said, the faith. So, if we look at the Buddha's teachings about faith, having a confidence that there is this valid refuge of a Buddha that can protect us, and that the fear and the faith work together. So when we do take refuge, is that enlightened mind that is free of all fault, that possesses every good quality, that is the ultimate refuge. But I don't know about you, but me personally, I can't directly talk to Buddha. You know, 2,500 years ago, I understand that there was Shakyamuni Buddha. I'm told that there are Buddhas everywhere, but my perception is not that pure. And so the sense is then I need, like, the teachings and the teachers, so that the teachings of the Buddha, the Dharma, I can hear those, I can read those, they're on the internet, you know, they're very accessible, and there are people who are teaching those. So the more we can take refuge in the teachings of the Buddha, the more it's like the signpost to how to be relieved of suffering. So the more and more that we practice it and reflect on it, meditate on it, make it our own experience, it's also not just something to study, something to hear about, but to contemplate, to meditate, and make sense for ourselves. So the Buddha, you know, said, you know, don't take anything that I say as truth. You know, check it out, test it. Test it like you'd test gold. You wouldn't just accept someone says it's gold. You'd go and get it valued, wouldn't you? You know. So we had this, last year we were doing these fundraisers and somebody gave us this, the citrine, a gem. And and you go on the internet and you find out a lot on the internet, and it can tell you a lot about it, and it can tell you, oh, it's probably one of these types, and it could be worth this much, or it could be worth this much. And so then you go to a jeweler, because the jeweler knows what they're doing, and the jeweler looks at it and tells you it's worth $1,500. So we've got this little gem worth $1,500. So it's good, just as well we didn't give it away for $50. It's worth $1,500. So you get things checked out, don't you, by the experts who know their field. So, and this is what the Buddha said, you know, actually you're the expert of your own mind, not me, Shakyamuni Buddha. We are each individually our own mind expert. So we are the ones to check out. So if it's something in the Buddha's teachings that you think, how could that be true? You can either dismiss it out of hand, or you can check it out, can't you? Just say, well, how can it be true? Let me think about that. How could that possibly be true? So this is what the Buddha said. If there's anything that you find here that it doesn't make sense to you, don't just to believe. So it's not about blind faith. It is about having faith, but it's faith based in having confidence that this is correct or makes the most sense to you. I mean, some things that we don't know, like I said, I don't know about, well, actually, there is a bit of evidence, isn't there, about past lives, and so therefore you can assume future lives if there's been past lives. Quite a bit of scientific evidence about that, where they've, you know, people have remembered past lives. So there's studies around that weren't there, you know, in the times of the Buddha, when it would have been more people to accept it on faith, what the Buddha said. Because somehow it makes a sense to us. Somehow the law of karma, you know, cause and effect, makes sense, sort of makes sense of. I was talking earlier tonight to people at my centre and thinking, as I do the program for our centre, the courses that we run, thinking, should we have a course named Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? I mean, it's karma, right? You know, but, and then we decided maybe not, because then they might come along and expect the answer, and we probably wouldn't give the answer. We'll just talk about karma. It's all cause and effect. So this is, you know, core in the teachings of the Buddha, understanding that, you know, so that anything negative causes negative, anything, you know, so non-virtue causes non-virtue, and virtue causes virtue, so that suffering is a cause of suffering, and happiness is a cause of happiness, you know, even sort of go on like that. So taking refuge, you know, whether it's in our mom or whether it's in the Buddha, it's not the immediate, it's not like you take refuge and then immediately you're free from suffering. You know, that, as I said previously, if the Buddha could take away our suffering, he would have done that, you know, immediately. So when we do take refuge, it means we're not necessarily taking refuge in the being, but actually in the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, so that and then we have to investigate the essential teachings and the fact that the most important teachings of the Buddha is this understanding of karma, the law of cause and effect, because it contains all the other teachings and also gives us guidelines for how we can live our lives. It sort of makes sense, you know, that if I only ever say things that are going to be of benefit to others, and my wish is to benefit others as much as possible, then what I'm saying and what I'm wishing, you know, it's the same. And so I'm developing my speech in that direction. If I'm always saying negative things, I'm being creating the cause for harm, enough disturbance in my own mind, you know, the words that come out, disturbing my own mind, but then creating a disturbance for others as well. And what the harm we can do with speech, I mean, we might not, any of us, pick up a gun or do any of those things, you know, unless you're doing sort of armed service or something. But, you know, most of us are not going to be going around shooting people and doing things. But the harm we can do with our speech, just look at kids, and have you heard kids in the playground at school? Hey, that's just like, close my ears. It's like, how can we be so cruel to each other? I'm not saying all the time, but there are, you know, that sort of without, when we don't think of the consequences, or we don't think there are consequences, so we think it's okay, or we don't think even whether it's okay or not, it just goes there, and then it's out, and it's done harm. So, and not to mention, you know, with our bodies as well, you know, with our physical actions, that can do harm. That we're very clear about. I think we're very clear about the harm that can be done. So if we're always thinking of our speech being in the direction of a, you know, may my speech be the speech of a Buddha. Okay, we're practicing, right? We're not there yet. Well, I'm not. So, you know, just practicing. So, you know, and it's very helpful because I, you know, when I do that, I think about the teachings of the Buddha, and I think about the teachers who have taught me that I take refuge in. So my, you know, sort of my spiritual mentors, my lama. And if I think about them, then I sort of can take refuge in that. So when I'm in a difficult situation, I can sort of say, oh, how would Lama Dzogchen Rinpoche deal with this situation? What would he say? What would he do? So it's like I'm calling on their wisdom, but really it's my own inner wisdom. But they're not here. Or maybe they are in some form. But it's really awakening our own wisdom, you know, that we're calling on. Okay. So practicing, putting into practice karma, it's not just something to study. But putting it into practice in our daily life is about being wise, being kind and being wise. It is, and it comes down to that, being compassionate, having that compassionate Buddha, having that wisdom. So if we can, you know, the Dalai Lama always says, you know, my religion is kindness. He doesn't say my religion is Buddhist. And says, well, he does say I'm a Buddhist, a simple Buddhist monk. But he says my religion is kindness. And the lamas that I have, you know, like I worked for this prison project, and one of the lamas went to visit Long Bay out here. And so one of the prisoners thought, I'll only have one opportunity to ask a question like this, you know, to ask them a question that's really meaningful in life, so I'll go for it. And he says, how do I make meaning of my life? And the lama said, be kind. And it's two words, be kind. Practicing kindness is incredibly powerful for me. So if I think, well, these lamas know a thing or two, they certainly know a lot more than me, if I regard someone like the Dalai Lama or the Buddha, which I do, then why not follow his advice? So the teachings of the Buddha coming through somebody who's alive today, who I can hear, I can see, and I can experience the teachings of the Buddha from. So this is the Sangha, the you know, sort of realized being who communicates the words of Shakyamuni Buddha, the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, and makes sense of it in, you know, 21st century in Australia. I'm not in sort of India 2,500 years ago or 8th century Tibet here. So that, I think, is the beauty of bringing the Buddha's teachings to life in a way that makes sense to us here and now. So that understanding that and thinking, be kind, be wise, is a way of developing compassion, developing loving kindness in our own minds, in our lives, in our actions, in our speech. So that practicing that, you know, becomes a daily practice, like thinking of waking up in the morning and thinking, may whatever I say and do be of most benefit to others today. It's putting our mind in that mindset. It's already putting our mind in the refuge of the Buddha. And then, like we did at the beginning, you know, offering respect to the Buddha is taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in the teachings of the Buddha, and taking refuge in the Arya being, the holy being, as our guide towards enlightenment. Because I know if I rely on my mind, I lead myself down a garden path very often. Garden paths can be very nice, but they can be a bit rocky sometimes. You know, a few years ago, in one of my confessions, it says, so it's always good to say it in public, so a few years ago, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who ordained me, and I was doing a PhD, and then when I got ordained, I was teaching at this university, actually, and I said, I don't need to have a PhD because I'm not going to be working at a university, and that was the only reason I was doing it in my life, even though when I started my PhD, I did have the thought that I wanted to write about something, research something that would be of benefit to others. You know, because, I don't know, a lot of PhDs sort of sit on the library shelf or in some computer somewhere and never see the light of day. Is anyone doing a PhD? Because otherwise I might have just depressed. You are? Did I just depress you? I'm sure you're doing something really important and meaningful. No, but we have to consider that, don't we? Like, if we're thinking about, is it what... Of course, nobody does it if it's not going to be a benefit, do they? Of course not. You do it because it's something that you believe is going to have benefit, right? So anyway, so I had that thought, and then I got ordained, and then I thought, well, I don't need to do that anymore. But I wasn't sure, so I wrote to Lama Zopa, asked his advice. And then after a year, I didn't get any advice. So I thought, that's all right. I know I don't need to do that. And as soon as I had that thought, almost immediately I got this email saying, best thing is complete the PhD and think of the benefits to human beings. The same thought that I'd had when I started. So that was the advice I got. I still haven't completed it. That's my confession. Okay. So in this life, hoping I don't die beforehand, I will complete the PhD. You are my witness. So why did Lama Zopa tell me that? Because he said that would be the best thing to do. That would be the thing that would be of most benefit. So my mind was saying to me, I don't need to do that, because I thought the only reason for doing it was to be lecturing at a university. But obviously it's got some other benefit. I trust the clairvoyance of Lama Zopa, and so trusting that, I say, okay, I better follow the advice. And I've been getting advice over the last few weeks about some decision I've got to make, and finally this afternoon somebody else, you know, this accountant, auditor, actually gave me this advice, and I thought, I keep hearing this same advice. And I first heard it from Geshe Sampson, who's my head teacher at my centre. I thought, he's the first one who gave me that advice, and I think this means you better follow the advice. So on a conventional level, ordinary everyday life, it's the best advice, and on a sort of, you know, ultimate level of, you know, wherever we're heading towards enlightenment, and we're getting my spiritual advice tells me the same thing. So it's like, okay, I get the picture, I better follow the advice. Or I can say I'm not going to follow it and be pig-headed. I'm very good at that. But I've got to say, well, if I really trust and I really have taken refuge and I really trust in the wisdom of my elders and spiritual guides, then I will follow their advice. But it's hard, because your mind comes up with all sorts of things. I don't know if anybody else relates to that, but my mind comes up with all sorts of things. And it's probably this thing of, you know, being attached to momentary happiness, or, you know, just thinking what's going to be the easiest thing to do right at this point in time, as opposed to what ultimately is going to be the most benefit. Again, the Dalai Lama says that if you're going to make a decision of short-term benefit and you've got the opportunity for long-term benefit, what's going to be best in the long-term? Always choose the long-term. So we can have short-term unhappiness if we know that long-term it's going to be. And that's nothing new to us. I mean, just look at those athletes, you know, those supreme athletes who train for the Olympics. And they undergo incredible pain, don't they? They get up, they're sleep deprived, they get up early in the morning and they train all day and to get, what, a gold medal, maybe. So we're very prepared to suffer a lot if we can see a long term benefit. So it's not necessarily just a spiritual thing, is it? We look for examples in ordinary everyday life. You know, anyone who's a mum, anyone a mum, anyone who's heard, anyway, I'm not a mum, but I've heard that giving birth is the worst pain you could possibly imagine, so all you blokes, just be happy that you're close, and support your women when the time comes, very nicely, I'm sure you will. But anyway, I'm told it's the most excruciating pain you could go through. But why do mothers do it? Because the benefit far outweighs the pain. Right? So we can look at those examples and say, you know, we still have the capacity to let go of momentary happiness if we think it's going to lead to something in the end. As I said, you know, work with these guys in prison, mainly guys, there are a few women, but it's people who contact us. So these people in prison contact us because they want to be learn meditation, they want to, they know their mind's disturbed, they know they're suffering, you know, they don't have to be told that, and they want to turn their lives around, they want to use the time they've got in prison to transform their mind, so they're interested in meditation, they're interested in Buddhism, and then, you know, they contact us and then we, you know, sort of provide them support. So they, we don't ask them what they've done to get into prison. But if you think about what people do to get into prison, they break the law, obviously. So, you know, to think that, you know, if I rob a bank, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get all this money and then I'm going to do all these things and then I'm going to be happy. And guess what? You end up in prison. It's a bit deluded. So we're all deluded. I have one guy, this is an extreme example. He was very unhappy about the radiation from mobile towers, you know, the mobile phone towers. Very unhappy about that. And so he decided he was going to do something, which he did. He broke into a military facility and stole a tank and drove it down the main street. And I just had to, I mean, we don't ask him, but he told me the story and I said, did you think nobody would notice? Anyway, so I don't see the relationship between that action and the mobile tower or how it stopped, but anyway, he ended up in prison. So he's ended up with a lot of unhappiness. He had a little bit of unhappiness about the mobile phone tower. You know, he could have found a more effective way to protest and campaign about it. But he chose a wrong way. That's an extreme example. I'm sure we all make decisions in life we regret later. And our minds are a bit deluded. In fact, Buddha would say all our minds are deluded. You know, we're all deluded. And we keep chasing after happiness where it doesn't exist. That sense of understanding karma, understanding the law of cause and effect, developing faith in the understanding that, knowing the qualities of it, and then practicing it, that being mindful in our daily life. So being able to observe the law of cause and effect. If you don't know how to do that, then working with prisoners is a really good example, because a lot of the time with the prisoners, they fight with children, not seeing the consequences of the action, not seeing that, you know, what is going to happen as a result of the actions that you do. So there's another example I can give of a very, you know, you could say that guy's motivation could have been positive in a way, but I think he was probably getting off on the adrenaline rush of stealing a train, I suspect. But anyway, one of the guys I was visiting in another prison was working in the kitchen, and he was really upset that there weren't enough fresh fruit and vegetables. And he was concerned for everybody's health, fellow prisoners' health. So it's a very altruistic thing, right? He was concerned for others. So they weren't getting enough fresh fruit and vegetables. And there he was working in the kitchen. And so he started sort of siphoning some away and taking them back to his cell. So he asked me about it and he said, look, my motivation's good, you know, so I should keep doing it, right? I said, do you notice where you are? Do you know what they do in prison? They spend their time observing your actions. That's what happens in prison. is that there are people there to observe what you do. And by the way, it's stealing. But anyway, so he thought what he was doing was good. And of course he eventually got caught. And then got taken off kitchen duty and sent out into the fields. Really, I think actually it might have worked out for him because I think he quite likes being out there, out growing vegetables. But it's sort of like not quite doing the right thing in the right way. And this is why we might not do those examples. We might think, well, I would never do anything like that. But we do need a guide, a spiritual guide, when you can't get to Christ. If I want to achieve enlightenment and I just sit down and meditate and go, excuse me, how do I get there? You know, where's the road? Where's the map? Where's the direction? So we need the teachers, to guide us to say, well, this is what you do and this is how, you know, you overcome all of that in your own mind, this is how you progress along the path, this is, you know, what's going to be best. And what's best for each of us is dependent on our own mind. That's why there's so many teachings of the Buddha, and that's why there's so many different, like even within Buddhism, you know, different forms of Buddhism, let alone all the other religions. You know, Buddha said there's 84,000 paths to enlightenment. I can't name them all, but that's what the Buddha said, so I trust that. So it's each according to what's most beneficial, and the skill of a Buddha or the skill of an excellent teacher is that they're able to speak to each one of us individually and make sense, isn't it? You know, you hear somebody and it just speaks to you. And I've sat there in teachings of many lamas and each one of us say, he was talking directly to me, or she was talking directly to me. No, no, she's talking to me. And all of us feel that, have that same experience. So that's the skill of a Buddha, where it is that. So we develop, you know, like with meditation we do at the beginning, the more that we contemplate even the qualities of a Buddha, and they make sense to us. Thinking about all the qualities, all the, you know, major and minor signs, the early two major signs of Buddha, the 18 minor signs, and what they all represent, and thinking about those qualities and thinking, you know what, I can be that too. So this is our real, you know, sort of refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and the Triple Gem. So the more that we take that refuge in those things outside of the outer refuge, you know, the actual historical Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha and those teachers, the more we develop our own inner refuge, our own Buddha nature. And then our basic goodness, our wisdom, our compassion, all of these things flourish more and more and more. We have everything that it requires right now to become a Buddha. And we have that innate wisdom, we have the basic wisdom, we have the compassion, we have all those qualities. This is another thing of more and more contemplating taking refuge, is overcoming our own doubts, our own fears. You know, like that one of, is it Nelson Mandela or is it Desmond Tutu? The one, Nelson Mandela, I think, said, our greatest fear is not that we are powerless. Our greatest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. And that's what we always say, beyond measure. So these are the things that we have to overcome. So it's overcoming fear. That's what becoming a Buddha is. Completely gone beyond fear. It's having a space for Buddha. So that's a little bit about what refuge is all about. Any questions? I've gone blah blah for a long time. Anybody got some questions? Sorry? how do you do that? What do you do to monitor your anger? Do you know, heard of Tenzin Palmer, Gypsum Tenzin Palmer? She was here just recently and she spoke at the Mitra conference for anyone. I don't know, did anyone go to the Mitra conference? One thing that she says is people like that who irritate us are our best teachers. In fact, there's this saying, you know, that you say, oh, my precious teacher, because they're our best teachers. Why? Why are they best teachers? Because they don't just agree with us. That actually challenges. And so that people like that, because you said it's very, very hard, and I would say fantastic, that's great. Because that means you've got to put effort. So you've got to put effort, as you said, to work with your own mind, which is fantastic. One, you notice it. And two, you recognise that it takes effort. Because it does. It takes effort. But these people give us that opportunity to apply that effort. And what Tenzin Palmer, as I mentioned, said, it's like these people are a sandpaper. They rub us up the wrong way in the sandpaper, but they make us smooth in the process. So sandpaper, when you do on wood, it sharpens, it smooths out all the rough bits. So they're actually, because you said that you bring out, you apply effort, and that's one of the six perfections, isn't it? The paramita, you know, is joyous effort, in fact. So joyfully go, fantastic, thank you for giving me the opportunity to work on my mind. Okay, if you can do that, that would be great. The wisdom is to, when you're with people, to observe what your speech and what your action, so you do that, but and then when you're on your own, watch your mind. So when you're with that person, as you said, it's difficult, you see it in your mind, right? But you don't necessarily say or do things. Or maybe sometimes we do, and then we regret it. So there's another deferral, just leave those aside for a moment. But then when we're, and this is the purpose of meditation, get familiar with, so you can even meditate on anger. We all experience anger. Anybody here does not experience anger? Okay, so you're not alone, okay? We all experience anger. Yeah, but that's not necessarily anger, that's skillful, that's direction. So you've got to distinguish the emotion from the actual giving direction. Or, you know, correcting mistakes. Yeah. So. Yeah. That's right. So, but what you need to do is separate out the anger. Anger is not going to change stuff, is it? The anger will not change things. So, so separately, you work on the anger in your own mind, you let go, and then, but then in the actual, you take the responsibility for what you need to do in terms of the project, because you have to protect the project. So it takes courage, really, doesn't it, to do that. It takes, you know, but first of all, take the emotion. And so the only way we can do that is when we're not in the situation. In the situation, it's like it's too late, isn't it? You need to separately just look at, you know, meditate on that. And, you know, we have practices with purification practice where you sort of at the end, you know, the thing that you do at the end of the day where you regret anything negative that's arisen in your mind, any harm that you've done with your speech, any harm that you've done in action. But, you know, and then, you know, just letting that go or visualizing that leaving your body, leaving your mind, and gradually clearing your mind of those things to really be rid of them. It's a gradual process to do that. But at least by starting, you can separate. You know, I've been in situations with people who irritate me, and I'm doing the practice in my mind, you know, while they're there, not while you're having a conversation, I'm not good at it like that. Some people already can do that. But separately thinking, okay, I'll calm my mind, I'll, you know, sort of let the emotion go, whatever you need to do to observe your own mind, and then you still need to take the action. It's not about becoming passive. It's not about being a doormat. It's not about inaction. In fact, Buddhism is very engaged action. Well, those sorts of questions you need to work out for yourself. But the thing is, the thing that, from Buddha's point of view, is to, it's not. So I can hear that the anger is. Does that disturb your mind? Does it disturb your mind? Sorry. So if the situation's like somebody wanting to beat you up, you get the hell out of there. And he was good. If that's true, because that's abuse, and you do not tolerate abuse. I mean, it's not. That is a situation you get out of, and you must have some superior that you can report to, or that you can get advice from on that level, right? You're not just doing this project in a void alone. You have some superior that you report to, you have a supervisor, you have somebody, right? So then the mechanisms are there, and they're there to protect you and the project, and you use them. You use those. So you do, you take what, and that's skillful means. The Buddha talked about using skillful means. You use what's there and do that, but separately, so your mind's not disturbed, you spend time to observe your mind, pacify your mind, calm your mind, so that you're not caught by the anger. Because if you reflect on anger in your body, in your mind, you know, if I reflect on anger and what it does to me physically, you know, my heart starts beating faster, I get hot, and then mentally, you know, I get agitated and irritated, and I might get short of breath, and I might hold my breath. And if you look at what a young child does, you know, what do they do? Throw a tantrum, and, you know. So it's not, it's not helpful. That in itself, the energy of anger, if you took the energy of the anger away from the anger away from it, that energy is very powerful. So that energy going in a positive direction is one thing. So you can use that energy of the anger to take action, do the steps you need to take, talk to the people you need to do, whatever. But that anger is what we want to not hold, not let grab hold of it. You know? And so this is why, and it, particularly at the times when you're not caught by the anger, spend time in meditation. You know, sort of one thing you can do is just like meditating on your breath to calm your mind, to pacify your mind, to get your mind stable. So it's not, you know, when it's angry, it's very hot and it's very excited mind. To cool the mind, to calm it. And then if you wanted to investigate what's the nature of anger, because anger is an emotion that it's not something like, it's not solid, is it? Like I can't touch anger, I can't open up and go, oh, there's anger, I think I'll take it out, I don't want that anymore. We can't, we wish we could, we can't. So it's not actually even, doesn't even exist in a way, like we can't. So but then we can say anger arises in our mind, but it's not there forever, is it? You're not permanently angry. You don't look to me like an angry person anyway. What does an angry person look like? Pretty ugly. This is why. The opposite of anger is patience. So if we can just, and you know, patience has the nature of beauty. So if you can, maybe even practice being patient with yourself in dealing with the situation, have compassion to yourself dealing with the difficulty of the situation, that will help you be able to move forward with it. So, you know, I think sometimes it's like, you know, when things are head on like that, it's like there's too many things going on and we feel like we have to solve it all immediately. Because guess what? We don't want that anger because it feels horrible, doesn't it? Feels awful. We don't want it. So the Dalai Lama, when he was here in 2007 maybe, was interviewed by Kerry O'Brien on the 7:30 report, is that right? And Kerry O'Brien said to him, the situation in Tibet, you know, it was, what do you think, you know, surely you get angry and, you know, that you can't resolve the situation. Many years the Dalai Lama's been, you know, talking about world peace and trying, you know, peace, blah. And the Dalai Lama said, well, what happened, he was talking about, Kerry O'Brien asked him about a particular incident, and he said, I watched anger arise in my mind, and I watched it fade away. And then he said, 1 minute. So it's almost like, he didn't do this, that was me hearing it and thinking, it's like this way, it comes up and it goes away again. And he said, 1 minute, and he said the reason that he could observe the anger and not be caught by it, so the anger was there, and it was like he was here watching it. He said, the reason I could do that is because since I was 6 years old, I've practiced meditating on my breath. So the Dalai Lama is 75 this year, so that would have been when he was about 73. So that's a lot of years. So we need to be patient with ourselves. And then in the meantime, you can, you know, take what steps you need to take and get people, get advice, get people to help you, you know, advise you to take the right action. Any other questions? You're trying to?
Through educating somebody, and they should be nervous, or they are in nervous. How do you deal with something like that? How do you deal with situations like that?
I don't know what it sounds a bit. Can you speak a bit more detailed about it?
Through our line of work, we might be talking to someone, and the whole reason why they do get angry is because they don't understand. It's good for one to know how to take refuge in the Zen and control our emotions. But how do we educate that to other people in a way that they can benefit from as well?
Yes. Well, in terms of educating others about the teachings of the Buddha, that's what you're saying. So, Shakyamuni Buddha taught because he was requested to. And so that is how, that is a tradition in Buddhism. For example, you know, again, looking at the guys in prison, the only people that we have contact with in prison are the ones who requested, come to us for help, come to us to say, I want to learn to meditate, I want to learn about the teachings of the Buddha. So you could say, and I'm sure the Buddha looked and saw, this can benefit all beings, right? Which is why he taught. But initially he taught because he was requested, so he taught those he was requested to teach, and then it grew from there, and look where it's all gone now. So that still exists today. So we don't really go out and try and change people. Because actually, we can't. So your colleague, you can't change. Your people that you want to educate, you can't change. We can model certain things. We can, and that's what we say, it's all very well to have it in your... Don't discount developing those qualities in yourself and the impact that that has on others. Just think for yourself, you know, when you've been around somebody who makes you feel good. No, I'm not talking about some, you know, intimate sexual blah blah blah. I'm not going there, right? But someone you just thought, it feels, you know, it's someone you like to be around, right? They have a feel good energy to them. Why they got that? Because they cultivated, developed that goodness, you know, in them. And you have that in you. And that has in itself has an effect. And then if somebody says to you, oh, how do you do that? You know, whatever, you know, I don't know. If they start to ask you things, yes. For example, like, as I mentioned, I used to be teaching here. And when I was going to get ordained, because it was actually, it all sort of happened quite quickly in the end. But anyway, when I had to go to my boss and tell her, or ask a request. I wasn't sure if I was going to never have the job again, but at least request her to have the time off to go to New Zealand, as it turned out, and get ordained. And so the first thing I had to say was, I don't know if you know I'm Buddhist. I've been working there for years. I said, I don't know if you know I'm Buddhist. She said, no, I didn't know that. Because I'd never said, oh, I'm Buddhist. But I was. And so I was doing my best to be, you know, a good Buddhist, doing the best I could. But I never talked about Buddhism because I was never asked about it. So what they say is, you know, Buddhists never talk about it until they're asked, and once they're asked, they never shut up. So I don't know, it might be true. That might be true. So just think about that, and think about, yes, so we can't really change other people. If the Buddha could have taken away the suffering of all beings, believe me, he would have done that. And any other compassionate, any other religious leader, believe me, they would have done it. If they could take away, they would. But it's like we all have that journey. So you can take the opportunity to, you know, sort of reflect on how you interact with others, how you talk to others. And, I mean, if you think that everything you want to say is going to be beneficial to others, if you do just that, boy, would you make a hell of a difference. Imagine everybody in the world only said what was beneficial. Wouldn't the world be so much quieter? Really. So just that. And then, if we want peace in the world, if we really want peace, if we want these qualities in the world, the way to start is in our own minds. And then there's enough beings, enough minds doing that. Eventually, slowly. I mean, Buddha's incredibly patient. Eons waiting for us to, you know, catch up. Okay, there's another hand over here somewhere. Yeah. Any other questions? The only person we can change is our own self. So every other being we cannot change.
Even?
I mean, have you changed a member of your family?
Yes.
Because you have to tell the rest of us how to do it.
So if it happens to be like that, so, and we know that several examples, they are wrong, and they are even like our family or something like that, so what should we do? Like, should we just...
Well, let's start this example over here. If there's something... So Shanti Deva is one of the Indian pandits. He said, if there's something that you can't do, don't worry. And if there's something you can do, don't worry. It's sort of like change it if you can. Like take action if you can. But don't let it disturb your mind either way. I mean, it's hard to hear in a way, we can't imagine it. So. Yeah, but if you, so if there's some action that you can take, obviously do that. I mean, ultimately, only we can change our minds, but we can think, I can think of people who've had a really amazing influence on you, and you can too, right? So they have had an impact, but it's us, it's like the Buddha said, don't take anything I say as truth. You check it out, you test it, you make it your own. And that's the same, we can be role models, we can advise, we can guide, we can use whatever skillful means we can. But even with the best intentions, it doesn't necessarily work for us all the time. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it's amazing. And then other times you don't even know what influence you're having on people. You have no idea what influence. But if you think that you want to only be beneficial, then whatever influence that is will be beneficial. So again, there's guys in prison. They're good examples to you because it's an extreme harsh place. That I was in this prison one time and this guy just walked in and said, when I see you, you know, you're just really peaceful and I feel peaceful. And I thought, if only he knew, I'm not being very peaceful at all in my mind, but it made him feel peaceful. So that was his mind, not mine. It had nothing to do with me. I was going chitter-chatter. And he goes, oh, you're really peaceful. And I go, really? No, I didn't say anything. I didn't want to disillusion him. But, you know, because his mind was peaceful, so let it be that way, because in prison, believe me, there's not a lot of peace to be had. So that's a positive thing, you know. But again, when I was working here, and my boss was really upset one day that people were gossiping about her and saying things that weren't true. Students were gossiping about her and saying things that weren't true. And she said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this and I'm going to find out who said what and blah, blah, blah. And I said, don't worry, students gossip, that's what they do, let it go. Because I could see her mind was disturbed and you don't want to be disturbed. But that just made her more agitated. So it wasn't skillful at all. I was trying to be skillful. I should have just shut up and said, yeah, you're right, you better find out that. I know, so we do what we can, you know. But don't expect that we're going to change other people. Because, hey, do you know your own mind? Can you really change your own mind? Why do you expect you can change another when you can't change your own? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same as yourself. Well, that's a perfect example of it doesn't work, isn't it? Uh-huh. You've just stated the point. Of course, the family can't change you, can you? Unless you want to be changed. And that's what it does when we try and change someone else. What happens? You feel misunderstood. So it's not a good look. So. I don't know, it's not my family. You find the words to speak to your family. But just, you can also learn from that. Well, if that's how it feels for them, you know, how does it feel the other way around? You know, so I'm not going to try and change anybody else. Inform them. You know, be compassionate, be kind, be loving, be generous. Actually, the best thing I have found when somebody irritates me is to be very kind. To be very generous. It's sort of like the last thing you want to do, because what do you want to do? You really annoy me, so I'm going to do something to you. You know, maybe you're not like that. Maybe that's just me. But to turn my mind around, that's really working with my mind. To think, this person really irritates me. What can I do nice for them? And what can I do that's kind? What can I do that's nice? And you know, it pacifies my mind a bit to do that. And again, there's another example that Tenzin Palmer talks about, only because she was here recently. She's got all these examples in my mind. Saint Therese of Lisieux, she's one of the patron saints of France, along with Joan of Arc. when she was very young, she always wanted to be a nun. And so she became this nun in an enclosed order, a Carmelite nun in a sort of Catholic tradition. She was Catholic, yeah. And anyway, so she was like 15 years old, and she's locked up with just, you know, like 30 nuns or something for the rest of her life. She actually died when she was 24, so the rest of her life wasn't that long, but what did she know when she was 15? So there was this one nun who really irritated her because she made these weird clicking noises, and she sat next to her in prayers or behind her or whatever, and she never knew when the clicking was going to come. So she got very irritated. She was just like, and she said, I've got to live with this for the rest of my life, so I better change my mind, because they're all in silence as well, you know. So she really thought, okay, I'm not going to try and avoid her, because she used to go out of her way to avoid it. Just, I will deliberately, you know, sort of walk down the same halls, and I'll smile, I'll be kind, I'll be nice to her. And so she did that, and then after a while, this nun said to her, why are you so friendly, so nice, you know, you're so kind to me. And of course she's thinking, it's only you, why? You know, I'm really working with my mind. So I shouldn't say that, because you couldn't just trust everyone who's kind and nice. But, you know, this is what, if we do that, if we actually, we're really working on our mind, it's an invitation to work on our mind and be kind and nice to the person. Because it's easy to be kind and nice to the person who loves you and agrees with you and makes you feel good. But to be kind and nice to somebody who irritates you, it takes, as you said, more effort. Be kind and nice to your family. They really love you. But don't worry, they won't change your mind because you love them. But that's okay. They're not going to change your mind. You can't control that, can you? And this comes up in prison all the time, because the guy, you know, it's a harsh environment and it's all about being tough. And so they always come up with this thing of, you know, what, you know, but they're only, then they make use of me, and then they, you know, as they take me for a ride, you know, they take everything or whatever. So if you can prevent them from doing that, then you actually have an obligation to prevent them, stop them creating a negative karma, if you have any power over that whatsoever. Maybe you don't, I don't, you have to be the example. But if you don't, it's also not just letting that go, you know. Shegawa, I think, one of the Tibetan masters wrote, who said, it's like we give the victory to others. So we, even though we think that that's not fair and we deserve all this happening in our mind, just allow that. You know, if you can prevent them from doing something that's going to create negative karma to themselves or others, you do that. But if you can't, just, well, if you didn't see it coming, you just have to say, it's okay, I give this victory to them. I know in my heart my intention, and it doesn't matter. So, because we get caught up with what other people think of us and this and that. So if we can let go of that, that's real freedom.